We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Message and data rates may apply or consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It's getting more and more dicey in the courtroom as the trial of Karen Reed continues on, and very different vibe as round two plays out as compared to what we saw last year in the trial one of Karen Reed. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, joining us to discuss. We got some clips to watch, some pieces to break down. I know you've been doing some research on this over the week. Tell me what you've been digging into in terms of Karen Reed and, you know, the odds of her being the person that's at fault here.
Thanks, Tony. Yeah, the anytime where we have cases like this, where we have a lot of conjecture and we have a lot of lack of substantial data points and real evidence that's being contested on both sides, and we have really subjective observations by witnesses on site that is inebriated with a lot of alcohol and late nights and all those things, I just look at data. I'm always looking at patterns of behavior from past to present and looking at laws of probability. And so with this one, because we're still muddled down where who said, she said, refuting back and forth. And so you look at what the defense is claiming, because right now prosecution's making the point that, hey, she hit him, she ran away, he died. I mean, that's kind of the basis of what they're saying. But what actually the defense is saying is that they're saying that he was assaulted and got in a fight inside the house and maybe a dog's involved. So that's what I do my deep analysis on. All right, so here's what the defense is saying. And so I looked far and wide as I could, doing deep searches, and the relationships of everyone inside that house outside of Karen. She knew everyone or people inside that house as long as that she was dating Proctor. I mean, O'Keefe.
O'Keefe.
Yeah. And so
that'd be an interesting relationship.
Who knows, man, right?
Exactly.
And so that was like roughly a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah.
So that's as long as she knew everyone in that house. And so everyone in that house knew each other either by marriage or relationship with inside the police department, not anywhere between 5 and 20 years, maybe even longer in some. Mm-hmm. In all that time span, of all that time together, there's nothing on public record. Who knows what goes on behind the scenes, but nothing in social media, nothing on public record, no charges of malfeasance against any of the officers in the house for impropriety as an officer. In other words, there's been zero reported actions of violence or aggression by anyone in that house for 5 to 20 years mm-hmm. of any of those relationships. And what defense is claiming is that on this night, we had a major deviation from those relationships. Mm-hmm. The likelihood of that, as if you're looking at law of averages, with the assessment I did, is 20%. There's only a 20% chance that something like that happened. And so when you're looking at only about a 20, again, very subjective, my analysis, obviously it's human behavior, so it's subjective. But if you're looking at such a low probability of that action happening inside the house when there's never, ever, ever been any sort of report or anything of that happening, that's what defense has to overcome. They have to be so solid in everything they're saying that it's going to sway a jury's opinion that that's probable. And so mm-hmm. that's what they're battling this uphill road on, is the fact that it just doesn't make any logical sense that there would be any sort of assault against, you know, O'Keefe inside that house.
20% chance of that happening. But what, I mean, okay, I get that part of it. That's one piece of the equation, though. Mm-hmm. 20% chance of there being somebody fighting and right. them getting into it and something going horribly wrong and he dies. What's the percentage, and I don't know that you'd have this, but I think it'd probably be insanely low, that then you have 40 plus other people going along with the story and all of, and people who don't even know each other that are going to be willing to put their lives, their career, everything on the line to frame Karen Reed to cover up that John O'Keefe got in a fight with one of the guys in the house or some of the, or whatever happened allegedly. That and then everybody's at this house party and they're all in the same place for the most part and nobody sees this everybody knows about it and they're covering it up, or somehow they snuck his body out to the front yard and still nobody noticed, and then somehow all the first responders are in on it too and they're all framing Karen Reed and they're all lying and saying she said I did it. And she's saying she didn't say that, even though some places she says she did say it. But her current stance is, I didn't say I did it or I hit him. It's did I hit him, even though she's on camera saying the opposite. So anyway, we go back to the laws of probability and in all of these people, first responders, the people testing blood alcohol levels, the containers themselves, all of it. Against Karen Reed. That's where it gets to be completely insane. Because I can understand the 20%, that's somewhat of a reasonable doubt if it was just that. But it wasn't like there was one guy in the house and then this happened and nobody could have seen it. You're talking a lot of people in the house. Nobody saying anything bad ever took place. People are actually complimenting Karen Reed via text on the way out, but I guess that's a ruse. And they're texting, hey, it was a fun night, you know, blah, 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 like you would normally do after a good night with friends. And somehow all of this is a ruse, and everything that Karen is saying is true, and everybody else is somehow out to get her. That's got to be like 0.00000 something yeah. percent at to go to that level, does it not?
Yeah, so the 20% is just the probability of violence against him at the house.
Yeah.
Irrespective of anything else. But
that
like
even feels
said,
high to me.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
In my 22 years with the FBI, never once did I see anything that could – I've never seen a conspiracy work. And even if I've been part of cases or investigations where – someone had a thought or idea to make an attempt, it fell apart within seconds because you can't – like you said – you can't herd cats. And when you're trying to do a mass conspiracy of a cover up of truth of observation, you just can't. No. It's one reason why you interview multiple people. And there's another way that when you interview too, that the entire thing falls apart. You know, one of the interviewing strategies and tactics that you want to do if someone's trying to deceive you is you have them. All right. So tell me what happened. You always want people to establish a timeline. People have an easier time lying forward than lying backward. And what I mean by that is they can make stuff up on the fly if you make it progressive, like, all right, so what happened next? So what happened next? So what happened next? Basically, if you want to see if someone is actually fabricated or not, saying, all right, so let's start from, all right, we know he died. What happened 10 minutes before that? What happened 10 minutes before that? What happened? So people have a very, very hard time remembering in reverse if they're making it up. So that is one thing that you can do to kind of assess whether we're dealing with a fictitious or not. And then when you cross compare that fabrication with at least one other person's fabrication or three, it becomes chaos within seconds. And that's why it's implausible. It's completely implausible.
It is. And that's the thing with conspiracies. Why do so many people believe conspiracies work and that they're true? I mean, now, not to say that there hasn't been a conspiracy in the world that has worked, because there has. But for the most part, your likelihood of them working with multiple people involved goes extremely down the more people you add into it. But it's believed by so many that, oh yeah, that's very plausible. That could be true. Is it just a fear of reality, a fear of wanting to deny that other human beings could be this bad, that they could potentially have the ability to do these things? So it must be a conspiracy that villainizes this group over here because this one over here couldn't do it. At the same way, I mean, it almost sometimes the conspiracies get far more villainous and a scarier world to live in, thinking that that could be a possibility versus the simple thing over here. It defies a lot of logic, which is why it's a conspiracy.
So there's a lot of reasons why people believe in conspiracies. So let's take a conjecture at this one. First of all, as Homo sapiens, it's what allowed us to evolve beyond Neanderthals and become the species that we're on the planet, is our ability to weave stories. And we gravitate towards stories that have meaning to us. And meaning to us is what's important here. So what happens is that in cases like this, again, there's a lot of reasons why people believe in conspiracy theories. But I believe there's some elements here of this type. And that is, if you like or dislike someone, you're then going to have confirmation bias. When you have confirmation bias, and the way our brains work is that you're going to only suck in information that allows you to validate your own opinion of what you believe happened subjectively. Mm-hmm. I like this person, so I'm not going to see anything that is negative. I'm only going to see the positive. And if the positive doesn't fit the narrative I'm trying to make it fit, then I'm going to create something that does. Hence, you get a conspiracy. And so we create patterns of behavior that may or may not be there to fit the outcome that we're looking for. In other words, they're not taking a very scientific approach to it. They're taking a very, hey, here's the destination I want. I'm going to fit the world around the destination I want, rather than saying, hey, let's take in data and see where it leads us. I mean, how many times have we heard that? Is, hey, let's go where the evidence brings us.
Yeah.
That's what you and I do, is we go where the evidence brings us and we try to interpret the things we're seeing to see what outcome we will get. It's why when looking at Richard Allen in Delphi, none of the data supports the outcome.
Yeah.
Because we kept looking. None of that pattern of behavior fits what the outcome wound up being. That's why I'm not sold on the outcome, because I don't believe the outcome, because the pattern of behavior didn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
This one, you know, we're just looking at patterns of behavior. It's not fitting the defensive narrative today the way they're presenting it.
Let's talk about this for a second, because you had mentioned at the beginning, okay, I like the person, so this is the narrative I want to believe. What happens when midway through that narrative that you're believing and you're behind it for a while, that person becomes very unlikable, or you just finally see who that person is? Now, I truly can't say that this snaps every person out of it, because there's plenty of examples in our world right now where it's like, that person is beyond unlikable and y'all are still like, rah, rah, lovely human being. But let's talk this specifically about Karen Reed. After that ID Discovery documentary dropped, where we got to see her in her own words, giving her testimony, which good job, Karen, on that testimony. You certainly gave it. You gave far more than you would give in a courtroom. And that's probably going to put you away. But she became very unlikable. I would say to most people, you would not look at that and go, oh yeah, lovely lady, like someone I would want to have in my life. More like, she's making Proctor look understandable at this point. People are actually looking at Proctor going, oh, I see why he felt that way. In some ways, I'm not excusing his behavior in any way, but I think Proctor's going to play very differently this time around. What is that once they become unlikable? Because we have seen it in this case. That thing aired, and the amount of people who are showing up outside of that courtroom is not in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, hundreds, as she used to have. Some would say thousands. I don't think we ever got to that level. But publicly on that court step, hundreds. It's like five.
Right.
It's like 5 to 10 a day, somewhere in that number, if that. She became unlikable. What? I mean, obviously that says a lot about her. What does that do to the person? What is going through her mind right now in terms of behavior, in terms of analyzing this, where she once had all of that adoration, then she opened her mouth, and then after that, everything went downhill. Is she telling herself that it's not her own words that have turned everyone off from her? What do you think she's telling herself to continue to get by? Or are we getting close to, like, you know, a narcissistic collapse at this point where, oh God, like the walls are closing in?
Boy, conjecture hat.
Yeah.
So if you're living with such a, like, if this was me and I was so self-centered and I was saw myself as a victim of everything, mm-hmm. and a system and people out to get me, and I've spent my entire life controlling a narrative around me in a very positive aspect, and I'm only wanting to not destroy that self-image that I have of myself, and yet people keep pounding on even more and more and more, you're going to feel deflated, you're going to feel lost, you're going to feel broken, but you're not going to change the fact that you think that you're innocent. You're mm-hmm. not going to change the fact that you're feeling like a victim. The only thing that can bring someone out of that is some really deep therapy, I think. I think, you know, I think we're seeing some silence, you know, from the media and a lot just because of these things. I mean, it shifted my, Tony, from the very beginning, mm-hmm. I'll be the first to admit when I shift my perspective on things, when we first started covering this case, I'm like, friggin' that department, Proctor, yeah. I was all in that they screwed up this thing. Now, granted, they did screw up a lot of things,
yeah.
but what happens is that she gave us more data.
Yeah.
Every time she opened her mouth, she gave us more data. And so I was able to then shift from looking at nothing but the police department to looking at the people at the house because of her data she gave, mm-hmm. to looking at her. And she gave so much data, you're now establishing patterns of behavior of all these people. The more patterns of behavior and arcs you're able to discover, you're able to come to reasonable conclusions on what is likely, mm-hmm. and not what is absolute, but what is likely and what's reasonable in this situation. And she did it to herself. And that's what's really sad. And it's hard, you know, with the loss of life, you know, that a friend, a father, you know, acting as a father for the niece and nephew, and, you know, a child, you know, when loss of life is here, you know, there's also a lot of other tragedies here. And she, I think she's a very tragic person because I think it's hard not to imagine she is not in a tremendous amount of pain right now.
Do you think that she believes she's innocent of actually hitting him? Or do you think she's looking at this as she's innocent because John's the one at fault here? John is the one who got in the way of her. John is the one who got in the way of the car. If he wasn't there, if he didn't try to get away, if he didn't abandon me, I believe that's even her own words, abandoned in something, then when she was angry and she threw it in reverse, if he would have just stayed in the car, I'd been fine. I mean, they rationalize back to, if you didn't do this, then this wouldn't have happened. You wouldn't have caused me to do that. And because you caused me to do that, that is your fault.
Right.
So is she looking at it from the aspect of, I am truly innocent, not factually innocent, where, like, maybe it's going to be difficult to prove that, because I don't think it's going to be anymore. But let's say it is. She's innocent in her mind because John is the one at fault. John shouldn't have left and tried to go into that party without her. He should have just stayed in that car. And then because she backed up and hit him, and because she saw him stumbling around, you know, allegedly, didn't look mortally wounded. I'm just basing it on her own words. And he was in the general vicinity of where she left him. Again, her own words. And she's concerned he got hit by a snowplow. Again, her own words, meaning if he's in the general vicinity and if he got hit by a snowplow, he'd have to be in the road. The plows aren't going into the yard. It's still John's fault because he looked to her. Didn't look mortally wounded. So she left. She felt it was all okay. It's his fault if he didn't signal for more help or didn't do anything. I wonder if that's the rationalization that's going on in her mind to allow herself to go down this road of, yeah, he's at fault and everyone else is out to get me. But you can't say that out loud. You can't say that story out loud because that won't play very well.
Yeah, I think no matter what, she thinks he's dead because it's his fault.
Yeah.
I think plain and simple. I mean, she's a victim blamer. Yeah. 100%. And whether she actually thinks that she did it or not, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know whether how blacked out she was from the alcohol or what her memory typically is or not is. Who knows? Because I think at this point, when you work so hard to convince yourself of a belief or a system or something, you totally disregard what was there before. I mean, our brains are pretty remarkable on what they can and can't do.
Yeah.
And so whether she, I mean, so here's what's funny. You know, we talked about the polygraph before. If she truly believes that she didn't do it and she's super implanted that memory on her, she could probably take a polygraph and pass it. Yeah. But regardless though, she is, like you said, she is his death. I can't imagine her thinking anything, but it's his own fault.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to. That would. I don't know how you could operate in the way that she is, unless that's what you're telling yourself.
Well, that's what she does.
If she did it.
So, I mean, it's not us even conjecture. I mean, she's given us her own pattern of behavior of how she says everything. I mean, remember last time we said only, I think it's 5 to 10% of the time is she outwardly focused on someone else, and it's not like in an empathetic way. I mean, every single statement is I. It's everything is about the impact it is on her.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. Completely contrary to a lot, I don't know the percentage, completely contrary to many, many, and I'd say majority of people out there, because the majority of people have a balance between focus on self, focus on others, and a healthy relationship is a balance between the two. And they ebb and they flow, sometimes a little more here, sometimes a little less here, but there's an ebb and a flow to balance because at a certain point, the people in your life want to have it about them. I mean, just think, you and I, Tony, when we have our pre-chats and we talk and during the week and stuff, you know, we ask about each other, what's going on, and it's a back and forth. This is what a relationship is. And in some weeks, if someone's having a bad week, you're a little bit more for them that week, and then it ebbs and flows back the other time.
Yeah.
She, on the other hand, as we're seeing, it's me. Zero have we seen. Now, granted, behind the scenes, there might be something, but on the surface of everything that she's projecting out to the world, there's nothing but the impact on her.
Yeah. This is a weird place to be in with this story, but I think we're there. Round one, I don't think the story of what happened that night was told very well by the prosecution at all. Karen still kind of walked out of that somewhat likable. They introduced all the bad guys right away. And then we saw all of that. It was kind of ridiculous the way it was laid out. Not that there wasn't bad behavior on the part of the police. There was. This was not a good investigation. But immediately we saw who Proctor was and was like, oh, my God, this is a bad guy. This time we're seeing Karen Reed. And she's not painting a very likable picture. I would guess that a lot of people, if you don't know much about the case, you're not dug in on either side, you're watching this going, oh, God. Like what, like a cold hearted, you know, self-centered individual this is. And then we're going to see Proctor come up here on the witness list for the defense. And he's going to testify and we're going to hear the same stuff again. The horrible text that he said, the very, you know, chauvinistic, you know, toxic male type, you know, things that he was saying about her. I'm wondering how it's going to play this time. I'm wondering actually how many people are going to go, yeah, I kind of get why he feels that way. Like, did he go over the top? Was he saying stuff, you know, very, you know, shitty about women in general? Yes. But
here's what I think.
Yeah.
I think so. From what I've seen, I think from him, he's owned it.
Yeah.
I mean, so think about this. So you've done these horrible things. You said these horrible texts. You're sexist, you're racist, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Here's the difference. She hasn't once said, I kind of blew that up. I sucked at that.
Yeah.
But what has he said? That's wrong. That was inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't have done that. I mean, so when you reach, because here's what human beings know, understand, and are looking for. They're not looking for perfection. They're looking for an awareness and effort.
Mm-hmm.
And when she is completely unaware of who she is and the impact she's having with the behaviors that she has, and she doesn't take her own accountability for it, and she's not showing any remorse for her actions and past deeds, that's very unlikable.
Yeah.
Now, here you have Proctor, flawed individual, flawed police officer. Oh, you mean like us all? Now, granted, to a level degree that most of us don't have to deal with because he's he's serving the public trust. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, though, he's lost his job and he's owning it. Now, granted, if he does that on the stand and says, you're right, that was wrong, that was inappropriate, and my actions jeopardized the investigation for something that should have been done mm-hmm. for the justice for the family, and I own that. Yeah. If he does that, who wouldn't have compassion towards that?
Because I don't think they're going to land the same way they did last time. And again,
I don't either.
I'm not sticking up for Proctor either. I'm just like,
people. It's an emotional, not picking up for anyone. It's just we're analyzing the emotional impact people have with the words and actions they take. People are, they're not looking, human beings, I say this often when I give my talks, people aren't looking for perfection, they're looking for effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a word I use all the time. There's three behaviors of trust that people need to have if you're going to inspire someone to trust you with the words that are coming out of the mouth and the mm-hmm. behaviors you're exhibiting. That is open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Vulnerability being the critical one that says, hey, here's what I'm good at. So you have some confidence. And here's what I'm not so good at.
Yeah.
Here's my flaws. Here's my character. And here's what I'm doing to work on it. Because I need to overcome these things mm-hmm. myself. Because that is giving people a feeling of safety. Because they now know, you know who you are. I can trust in what's coming out of your mouth. Because if you're willing to tell me all that you suck at, then you're willing to tell me anything.
Yeah,
and that's what, if we hear that from him on the stand, you're going to trust his words. If we don't hear it from her and we're not hearing it from her, are you trusting anything she says?
She's got to show some humanity. And the thing is, Proctor is, I mean, if he's going to do exactly what he did last time, it showed humanity. It showed not a great human being, you know, at least really bad actions and decisions at that point in time. But it showed humanity. She has not shown any of that. I wonder if she will take the stand. I feel like, I don't know that she has a choice at this point. I don't think she will, but there is no humanity in Karen Reed coming across to this jury at all. Right. Proctor may actually work against her this time, because everybody in their right mind who's ever known somebody that's really demonstrating themselves as being a not so great human being. Yeah. In the background, like, yeah, people make comments and they're not always so nice. I wouldn't use the same words Proctor did, but they wouldn't be very positive to describe someone that's not a very good human being to other human beings that you care about. So, I mean, you can kind of understand his language. Again, not my choice, but that's how some people do express themselves. And it shows human. It just shows natural human emotions. And that's something that we're not seeing at Karen in any shape or form.
You know, and I apologize for this, Tony, but I remember, you know, when they first went to retrial on this, I was like, what the hell? What new things are we going to learn? But actually, we've learned a lot. I'm actually very glad they're doing a retrial on this, because there's a couple of things. We've learned more about Karen. We've learned more about Proctor. We've learned more about the process, too. Because the last thing I want to say is context is so important with every single situation. The context is, I got a little more data today about the collection of the evidence using a solo cup and all these other things that you're like, what the hell was going on here? But as I read it today, they're like, well, when you're in the middle of a blizzard, you don't have resources, you don't have all these things, but they had the wherewithal to know they had to collect evidence, do things. From, again, I don't know all the data and details, but it really reminded me, unless you're in that moment, living the environment of what's going on, it's hard to make a judgment on right or wrong or what should or shouldn't have been done unless you're actually in that context. And so mm-hmm. I got a little more data on that and how they did collection of evidence, mm-hmm. you know, that made me say, huh, I need to look at this a little deeper because maybe it was appropriate. Working with as limited resource they had in the middle of a blizzard, maybe they did the best they could.
I think they spelled it out pretty good. I mean, it's, again,
not
ideal by any, nobody's looking, and they didn't even look at it as ideal, but it was like, it's now or never. Like, either we're going to do something to get this or we're just not going to get it. And they erred in the side of caution. Like, well, either we do it now or we don't. So let's do something.
It's not perfect, better than nothing.
But yeah, better than nothing. There's so many questions. This is a far more interesting round of this trial.
It really is. I'm much more so than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens here in the coming weeks.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.